This is Phil Ferrand. And I am driving home. My voice is a little bit, my voice is a little bit worn out today. When I have to talk through a mask, I try to over-enunciate and project a little more so it's easier for me to communicate. And after, you know, a couple hours of that, it starts to wear down. So anyways, all is well. Today was the celebration of Mother's Day and the celebration of motherhood. So yeah, this outfit pretty much pushes the line as hard as I'm ever going to push between delight and disgust. We've talked about delight and disgust. And for this outfit, I normally, for my outfits, I've been doing three videos. So there's the bit, what I talk about when I, you know, do the outfit. So there's normally the bit, and then there's the making of, and then there's a reaction video. So I talk about people's reactions and that sort of thing. It was fun today. It was fun.
Oh, man.
There was... Yeah, it was fun. So... Anyways, I'm going to add a fourth video today called the PSA. It's public service announcement. And because I will have people that are just completely, they just won't be able to process the outfit. So that's okay. It's all right. And I thought, you know, you just better go ahead and do a PSA. And I'm going to talk about stuff that I've talked about on the podcast before. But specifically, when we talk about gender relationships from a systems analyst standpoint, I'm going to specifically talk about variances in humor. This really is a fascinating thing to me, that humor can be very much have a gender component. So there are certain types of humor. So you can ask people and they just go, yeah. That's right. And so do you understand that sometimes men tell jokes that women don't find funny? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yep. Yep. So do you understand that women can tell jokes that men don't find funny? Oh, yeah. Yep. 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 And so that's somebody I was trying to be nice and give someone else the right of way. And apparently I offended them. So that's why we got beeped. So then the next step that you go to is, do you understand that there are things that men find funny that disgust women or offend women? Yes, yes, okay, we got that. Do you understand that there are things that women find funny that might offend men? Yes, yes. So you have these spheres of delight and disgust, and they intersect. That's what's really fascinating. They intersect. And so since it was Mother's Day, I decided, you know what? I'm going to push as far as I can into the delight side of this equation for women. And I don't really care how disgusted men might get. Now, there was no problem today. We were fine. All was well. But yeah, it was fun. It was fun. So we got to do the PSA. On that, I think I probably mentioned that I was working on this outfit. I did get the outfit as done as I wanted to get it for this year. So, I was working on the bloomers last night, got them finished up around 11:15, got everything cleaned up. Oh, I was in bed. I was in bed at 11:45, which, 11:45 was actually the earliest I've been in bed probably for 3 weeks now. Certainly, once my wife got bitten by the dog and she needed extra help, you know, just getting ready and all that sort of things, certainly that shifted my schedule, because my wife is a night owl. She likes to stay up late at night, and so I shifted my schedule so that when she was ready to go to bed, we could kind of take care of everything and get her CPAP machine going and all that kind of stuff. And so that just sort of naturally shifted my schedule. But then I've been putting in 3 to 4 hours a night on the costume for Mother's Day. And I made myself a kind of a law, and the law was, you are not going to start working on that costume until you have your words in for the day. So I was getting off work, which thankfully we've been away from the building now. So, I mean, that saved me 40 minutes a day right there. Plus another 30 minutes a day because I didn't really need a shower. Well, I would take showers occasionally, but you know, you kind of just get up and you just go downstairs and start working. So I had some time savings there. So I would, you know, get off work, depending on the day, get some supper. If it was Tuesday, I got some supper. And then, oh man, I'm starting to come down. Sorry, I'm yawning. Starting to catch up with me. And then I would sit down, get all my writing down. And then once I got my writing done, then I'd start on the costume. But, you know, it's fine. I mean, it didn't turn out exactly like I thought it would at the beginning of it, but you adjust. You go along, you adjust, and, you know, everything's great. And it worked out great, so it was good. The writing is going along well. I've already heard back from a bunch of the beta readers. They've sent their books back, so I've got that under control. Here in another three weeks, another 3 weeks or so, we'll have the beta readers. I'll hop back over and start doing the final edits for book 12. Book 13 is going fine. I'm on schedule. I'm actually 500 words behind this week. And that's just because I had some things to finish up last night for today. So, of course, that took precedence and got it done. Excuse me. Wow, all of a sudden, I'm getting tired. I think I've kind of been just pushing and pushing and pushing to get this project done. And, you know, now I've got all the stuff. I'm going home, going to do the videos, pull it off, retire this costume for another year. But this went well. It went well. It went as expected, which is not only fun because people seem to enjoy it. It was not only fun, but it also, again, for me, it lends credence to the work that I've done in terms of gender relationships from a systems analyst viewpoint. Because this was designed specifically to hit the guiding principles in that. And, you know, it seems to work. So, yay. Anyway, so that's all well and good. Writing's good. Family is good. No one has caught COVID yet. But, of course, we're all starting to get back out and around. And so we got to get that figured out as far as Nana goes, mother-in-law. She's just been hunkered down and hiding. And we've been doing her grocery shopping for her and all that sort of thing. But that has gone well. She's still okay. You know, it's going to be interesting to see now that we're opening back up. I would hope that we have the will to just see this through. It seems to me that if you don't have a vaccine and there's nothing coming within the next few weeks, because we can't just shut down the whole country for months. We've already seen what it's doing to the unemployment rate. So if we don't have a vaccine in the next few weeks, which we aren't going to, then really herd immunity is going to be our next best bet if we can actually develop herd immunity. So Sweden is doing that great experiment now, and people seem to be finally coming around to Sweden's viewpoint and saying, yep, that probably was a pretty good idea. And the idea is everyone who is at high risk for COVID-19, if you're over 65, if you know, over 60, if you have existing health conditions, if you just go hide, let the younger, stronger people get it, develop antibodies to it, and then cut down potential transmission rates. That makes a lot of sense. So I don't know what medical advisors the Swedes had, but that seems like a much more sensible approach to take. And it will be fascinating when the documentaries come out and they show the different countries and examine the different countries' approach I mean, that to me would just be a fascinating, fascinating documentary, comparing government to government, when decisions were made in the government, who was making them, what they were taking into consideration. That would be really cool. Anyways, I have the paper folded here. I did put some notes. I forgot what we're even talking about today. Oh, man. This thing has just consumed. This costume from Mother's Day has just consumed. Oh, yeah. This is a fun topic. I read this article, and I guess it's a couple of years old, but it's, you know, it's pretty interesting. So this is podcast 580, by the way. The name of the article is Why Religion is Not Going Away and Science Will Not Destroy It. I thought, oh, that's pretty good. Let's talk about that. So the author opens the article by saying that in 1966, just over 50 years ago, the distinguished Canadian-born anthropologist Anthony Wallace confidently predicted the global demise of religion at the hands of advancing science. Quote, belief in the supernatural powers is doomed to die out over the world as a result of increasing adequacy and diffusion of scientific knowledge. Okay, so, and he wasn't the only one. There were a whole bunch of people who were absolutely convinced that science was going to do away with religion because it would just explain away everything. Here we are 50 years later, more advanced in our science, and that doesn't seem to be happening, you know? You've got plenty of places around the world where, like India, Israel, Algeria, Turkey, that their secular governments, Israel, what? Israel's secular government has been replaced by religious one, or have seen the rise of influential religious nationalistic movements. Okay, that's Israel. Secularization, as predicted by social sciences, has failed. Now, in the West, we do see a decline, definitely, in religious practice and belief. Census data in Australia says that 30% of the population identify as having no religion, and this percentage is increasing. International surveys confirm comparatively low levels of religious commitment in Western Europe and Australia. Even the United States, a longtime source of embarrassment for the secularization thesis, has seen a rise in unbelief. The percentage of atheists in the U.S. in 2017 was at an all-time high of around 3%, according to this article. Yet for all that, globally, the total number of people who consider themselves to be religious remains high. The demographic trends suggest that the overall pattern for the immediate future will be one of religious growth. But this isn't the only failure of the secularization thesis. Scientists, intellectuals, and social scientists expect that the spread of modern science would drive secularism, that science would be a secularizing force, but that simply hasn't been the case. If we look at those societies whose religion remains vibrant, their key common features are less to do with science and more to do with the feelings of existential security and protection from some basic uncertainties of life in the form of public goods. A social safety net might be correlated with scientific advances, but only loosely. And again, the case of the U.S. is instructed. The U.S. is arguably the most scientific and technologically advanced societies in the world, and yet at the same time, the most religious of Western societies. As the British sociologist David Martin concluded in The Future of Christianity, published in 2011, there is no consistent relationship between the degree of scientific advancements and a reduced profile of religious influence, practice, or belief. And one of the interesting things about here, that the secularists, those who would like to see science done away with, one of the interesting things about that is that the secularists have all assumed, this is their assumption has been, that science creates secularism. That as soon as you have scientific thought, that drives out all religious thought. But in fact, science is not the enemy of religion. Secularism is the enemy of religion. He says the writer of the article goes on to say, the story of science and secularism becomes even more intriguing when we consider that those societies that have witnessed significant reactions against secular agendas. India's first prime minister, Jawaharlal Nehru, championed secular and scientific ideals and enlisted scientific education in the project of modernization. Nehru was confident that Hindu visions of a Vedic past and Muslim dreams of Islamic theocracy would both succumb to the inexorable historical march of secularism. There is only one-way traffic in time, he declared, but as subsequent rise of Hindu and Islamic fundamentalism adequately attest, Nehru was wrong. Moreover, the association of science with secularizing agenda has backfired, with science becoming a collateral causality of resistance to secularism. So, in brief, global secularism is not an inevitable end, and when it does happen, it is not caused by science. Furthermore, when the attempt is made to use science to advance secularism, the results can damage science. The thesis that science causes secularism simply fails the empirical test. So that's pretty interesting. That's pretty interesting. Anyways, I am home. I do have to do some videos. So I'll finish this up real quick. The article goes on to say, the conflict model of science and religion offered a mistaken view of the past, and when combined with expectations of secularism, led to a flawed vision of the future, because we have interpreted things like Galileo and Copernicus and all those things, and we've gotten this idea that's been foisted on us that religion has always denied science, but that is just not true. It's just not true. So, the real question is why we will continue to encounter proponents of science, of the science-religious conflict. Many are prominent scientists. It would be superfluous to rehearse Richard Dawkins' musing on this topic, but he is by no means a solitary voice. Stephen Hawking thinks science will win because it works. Sam Harris has declared that science must destroy religion. Steven Weinberg thinks that science has weakened religious certitude. Colin Blakemore predicts that science will eventually make religion unnecessary. Historical evidence simply does not support such contentions. Indeed, it suggests that they are misguided. So he concludes the article by saying, religion is not going to go away anytime soon, and science will not destroy it. If anything, it is science that is subject to increasing threats to its authority and social legitimacy. Given this, the science needs all the friends it can get. Its advocates would be well to stop fabricating an enemy out of religion or insisting that the only path to a secular future lies in the marriage of science and secularism. Because science is merely investigation. It's merely investigation. And the only time it comes into conflict with religious teachings is when you have people trying to, for instance, interpret the Bible in a very rigid and Western objective way. And so then you come up to certain conclusions and you say, see, the Bible is wrong there. Well, the Bible isn't wrong there. It might be using allegorical language. But when you try to come at the Bible with a Western, rigid, objective mindset, you miss a lot of the allegorical stuff. So, you know, that leads people then to think that science and religion are opposed to each other, and they're not. They're absolutely not. Because, as I'm fond of quoting, the proverb says, it is the glory of God to hide a thing, and the glory of kings to seek it out. Our scientists are the kings of our age, and they seek things out. It's wonderful. And as we've talked about over and over on this podcast, in fact, the farther we get down into things, the more we make discoveries, the more astonishing they become, the more the body amazes us with its complexities. And I think we eventually get to a place where we realize that this is impossible. It could not have happened by itself. it had to be designed. And that means that science will not lead to secularism. In fact, science eventually will lead to religious thought because people will say there has to be a designer. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.